Yeah. If I may proceed then, Al, I guess with this series, I'll try and give you this morning a report, really, of the Habitat Conference and the Habitat Forum, which were convened at Vancouver, British Columbia, starting at the end of May and going through until the 11th of June. And I want to give this really as a report because I'm going to be reporting back to the churches when I get home next fall. You see, I was privileged to be there because of an invitation by the World Council of Churches, who were a part of the what was called the NGOs, the non-government organizations. And so we were invited, and we were one of the non-government organizations, that is the World Council of Churches. I was a part of a Lutheran delegation. There were 20 Lutherans from the West Coast of the United States. And so we lived together in a body Vancouver School of Theology provided rooms for us and also food that was made available at a relatively reasonable cost so that it didn't become so financially prohibitive. And then we had a small grant from one of the Lutheran church bodies to kind of offset a part of this. Well, this is the occasion that made it possible for myself and two students from California Lutheran College to be there at the same time. And we were there then for a full 2 weeks. Now, I think it's important that we go back just a little ahead of this and pick up some of the important things that happened ahead of the conference and ahead of this forum so that you you get a feel for what was planned and what the program really was. The first thing that happened was a conference convened in November of 1975 by the American University School of International Service and also the International Development Group. And they convened in Washington for 2 days to discuss and to raise the consciousness of the United States in relationship to human settlement, world housing, and this kind of thing. And they brought in the principal speakers who were to be the keynoters in the conference and in the forum so that their ideas could get out and get some publicity then and some germination before the conference actually took place. And Enrica Penaloosa was chosen as the director of the Director General of the Habitat. And he simply was the keynote addresser at this particular conference and kind of guided the conference through its entirety. And just a few notes about his emphasis. And he pointed out that in the next 25 years, the world will have to build as much housing as it has built since the beginning of time. The next 25 years. Roughly by the year 2000, we will have to provide as many human dwellings as has been provided in all of the history of the earth, as far as humans are concerned. Now that's a staggering thing just to think about. And this is what he said was the real reason for concern and why it was important that we get together. He pointed out that in the year 1900, 4/5 of all of the humans on the earth lived in rural areas. And by the year 2000, 2/3 of all humans will live in urban areas, basically large cities as we see it at the present. He also pointed out in relationship to this kind of providing for housing and shelter that half and more than half of the people in the world are presently ill-clothed, ill-fed, and ill-housed. This is more than half of the total world population. Also, that this half or more, the housing density for this half is more than three people per room. Just putting it into cubicles, more than three people in more than half of the population of the world live three people to a room. And more than half of the people have no water in their homes worldwide. And more than half of the people in the world have no electric lights. So when you start from this base, you can see why there was a necessity for trying to address ourselves to this and doing something about it. He points out that land is one of the basic ingredients that relates to properly housing people and properly providing communities for them. The landless peasants and the landless squatters in the world are just increasing in tremendous abundance at the present time. And of course, this is a problem that will no doubt get much worse. Now, he points out too that houses for the poor, the really poor, have always been built by the poor, and that this is the way it will have to continue to be thought of. So that we're going to have to think in terms of what we can do to help them build their houses, not thinking about how we can go build a house for them. There aren't enough resources, there isn't enough money, and so on. So we're going to have to help. And he says we're going to have to accept the fact, as much as we do not like it, that much of this housing in the next 25 years is obviously going to be substandard by any kind of evaluation that you put on it. But he said, let's make sure it's not subhuman. And that was his key point. Let's try to raise it to the point where and accept it as being substandard, but not subhuman. Then, this was a conference basically of United States people and Americans, except for the dignitaries who had been brought in. And this was to get us in tune with what our problem is. And I would like to read you the questions he posed to us as Americans. And he simply said this, are you in this great and rich country satisfied with national housing and urban policies? Are you satisfied? Are you satisfied with millions of acres of the best arable land each year being taken from agriculture and turned into spreading suburbs? Are you sure that you need twice the energy consumption per capita as the people of Sweden? Are you satisfied with the design of your metropolitan areas and the automobile traffic and pollution found in these great cities? And he said, it is in fact not too much to say that your concern for housing everywhere can best be shown by your concern here at home. And that's the way he ended his keynote to this group. Now, in this group, Margaret Mead, Dorothy Ward, and experts, all of the United Nations, and people around the world were convened to consider these kinds of things and set the stage then for Habitat Conference in Vancouver and so on. Now, let's point out...
Where was this fellow from, the keynote?
I've forgotten. I meant to look it up, and I don't recall. Leo, we'll have
he's
to look
Asian.
It up. Yeah, he's from the Third World, and I'm not sure which country. The conferences which preceded Habitat Conference, which was a UN-sponsored conference, the one where the question was raised was in 1972 in Stockholm, which was a conference that dealt with the human environment, but didn't really centralize its concern on people. It made its concern the environment. The second conference was held in Bucharest, and that one made its concern human population and the great population expansion. The third conference following that then was at Rome, which dealt with food on a worldwide basis. And the fourth conference dealt with women and their part in the evolving structures. That was in Mexico City. That was last year. Now, then that brings us up to 1976, Vancouver, Human Settlements Conference. And the 2 days that preceded the conference was a special time, again, for the experts to get together and the people who had been studying these matters in detail to place before the conference and before the Habitat Forum certain things that they thought should be accomplished. And I think it's worth looking at these just to see what was the expectation. And so let me just hold up for you then these things that they pointed out as priorities and really as demands that they felt the conference should deal with and the Habitat Forum should deal with. Number one, and I won't give all of these, there were 14 of them, but let's just give some of the highlights. Control over land use. And one of the main points here is that the community should benefit from all aspects of land, particularly from land appreciation. That is, when the land becomes more valuable, the net gain should go back to the community because it's what happens in the community that makes the land valuable. So the speculator should not reap the profit off of this. The profit, in a sense, should go back to the community. This became a very sticky issue, as you can well imagine, between the developed world and the underdeveloped world. And he said, they said finally, there should be some organization of national space that really relates to land and land use. Number two, reinforcement of small cities and rural settlements to take the pressure off of the big cities. In other words, rather than bringing people into the big cities, make it equally possible for them to earn a living and have the amenities of the communities that they should have in the rural areas, and particularly in the small and intermediate cities. This was an objective they thought the conference should address itself to. Number three, self-help to migrant communities, particularly in developing societies. That is, help them to help themselves. And one of the ways in which they said this might be done is giving them some security of tenure, so that when you build, whatever you build, you're assured you can stay there. Whether you own the land or whatever, at least give them an assurance of tenure.
Was this directed to the United States?
No, this is to the world. This is to the world now. Yeah. And they should also have services. And they should have clean water. And that they should have clean water by a certain date. They said that the conference, the world, ought to fix a date and say that by this time we will see that individuals have clean water in their settlements and in their communities that's available to them. And the emphasis again on recycling and conservation of resources that are available. And number four, which became a sticky issue, there should be a moratorium on nuclear power and emphasis on economically cheap solar energy. So this group, you see, of intellectuals that were meeting ahead of the main conference said, this is what the conference ought to do. They ought to declare worldwide moratorium on nuclear power and go all out for solar energy. This became a very debated issue, as you know. Number five. Full participation of all residents in decision-making and policies for their settlements. That is, everybody should have a say in what the settlement is like, what your dwelling is going to be like, the services, and all of this. Now, it's not just something that's done by the government and made available to people, but it's something people have a hand in doing, and they make the decisions. There should be a reorganization at the national level, at the regional level, and down to the local level, really putting the emphasis locally. And number six, a new direction in research, and in particularly in research by countries, by governments, by academic institutions in relationship to human settlement. There ought to be a new data bank, a new database developed so that we have correct information around the world, what really the situation is in relationship to humans. And number seven, a commitment to make basic services a first call in capital assistance. In other words, to make this a top priority, that these communities be given proper services and so on. Then, so much for that. And these are highlights that are before the conference now, before all of the delegates of the conference, and before the NGOs, you see, in the forum. Now, so that you understand how it worked in Vancouver, I think it's important. The delegates were housed downtown in the big hotels, and they had their meetings in the Queen Elizabeth Theater and Playhouse area, which had wonderful facilities for this kind of thing. And it was a beautiful place to meet. And I might tell you that there was, in any meetings of the world, there has never been security, I think, like the security they had around that place. You couldn't get in or out without a complete search, and they pocketed everything you had on you, including a pocket knife. You couldn't even go in there with a pocket knife that long. I had one, and I had to leave it. So, I mean, the security was tight. They were concerned about what might happen at the downtown area. They were not so concerned out at the farm, where we were, and the security wasn't that tight out there. But we met at Jericho Beach, which was a place where the Indians, when they came to this particular area, used to meet. And it was a beach, and the beach had later been made into a series of hangars for the Royal Canadian Air Force. And so seaplanes had been there, but the hangars were all abandoned. And the hangars now were made habitable for this conference. And I put the word habitable in quotes because there was no heat, and we happened to hit 10 days of very cold weather. So we wrapped up in Royal Canadian Air Force blankets, and each one of us sat around. There were 3,500 of us at times, you know, just covering and huddling under blankets to keep warm. Because what they had done, they had used volunteer help, they had used waste wood to build all of the platforms and all of this seating, and it really was truly something that you had to admire. But they had not gone far enough to seal up the cracks, and so we really had a cold time. But that was the setting for the farm. Now, downtown, you see, they were well housed and so on, but out here, then people lived all around and they came. The city of Vancouver provided bus service from all points, different points of town where people were housed. And so you could get on and off the bus. All you had to do is you had your habitat button. And I might just tell you, this habitat button, which I'm wearing here, you see a circle. That's the earth. You see inside of the circle a triangle, which is a house, an A-frame. And then inside of that, you see standing on the earth and in the house is an individual with two arms stretched out like that. So that was the habitat symbol. And the city of Vancouver was just plastered with these kinds of signs and flags and so on. So it was a very gala kind of an event from their point of view. Now, another highlight, and I just want to pick up some of these highlights that were emphasized. Barbara Ward made a strong pitch to the churches at the very outset of the conference, and there were lots of church organizations there, including our own. You see, and she said, fight for the poor. She says, fight for the poor. She says, harass the politicians. And she says, you can do this where other people can't, and you do it in the light of being radical in relationship to the Lord and what his command would be, you see, in this sense. So be radical in that sense and fight for them. And she says, number two, live slightly less affluent, you see, yourself. You better be an example. So we'd better be an example and then fight. So this was her thrust. Now, another important thing that was set before both the conference and the forum was something of the minimum standards that were conceived really by the UN Council and their staff, you see, and simply saying what should be the basic minimum things that every community should have. Number one was clean water. Number two was disposal of human and solid waste. Number three, community or education center. There should be some kind of a community center around education. Transport facility of some kind to get emergency services. And there should be a road that connects you with the next settlement. And then finally, there should be equity in sharing resources. Really a charter for the rights of the poor. And these are the minimums that were set up as for something to really be considered. Now, getting on then to the conference itself. The conference was opened, of course, by Prime Minister Trudeau. And he made a very eloquent talk that was well thought out and, I'm told, excellently delivered. This was in the conference, and I was in the forum. I wasn't there on that Sunday, but it was available to us in closed-circuit TV so that we could hear all of these things wherever we were. But he simply made two very strong points, very eloquently. Number one is that we must be concerned with the increase in population. That is the numbers, just the sheer numbers. And he hung his talk on the fact that in 30 years, our population will be doubled. In 30 years, there will be two for every one now. So that was his premise. And he pointed out that being the case, we're going to be so closely associated with one another that the only way we can live together is with a compassionate kind of love for one another, in seeing that we live well on the earth. And he took as the basis for his thesis, and he quoted very frequently from Teilhard de Chardin, and as a student of this kind of thinking. And he quoted this from Chardin. And he said, this is my position. And Chardin's quote was, I believe it would be ridiculous to think and to act as if our numbers on this earth were not so great. Numbers are already creating overwhelming problems for mankind with respect to shelter, food, drinking water, education, employment, government, and in a word, all aspects of our concrete existence. And that's the way he concluded it. Now, there was another first, really, in this conference that had not been present in any of the other world conferences. And that was a rather strong representation of indigenous people, the Aboriginal population, in a sense. The Canadian Indian and the Eskimo, they were both there, and well represented by very articulate people, and they spoke very forcibly to the forum And they got written statements into the hands of all of the delegates, and they made a very strong pitch for their land rights, which they feel they have been deprived of. They claim, and they made their point, that they are squatters now on their own lands, and they have no rights. And so they made a strong appeal to the assembled body that something should be done about this. And it was a very interesting confrontation that took place right in the farm, and actually almost in front of where I was sitting. The Eskimo who had been addressing the conference had prepared a statement and conditions that he wanted to see accomplished by the Canadian government. And he knew that the Prime Minister was due to visit the farm at this particular time. And so it was well timed. And when the Prime Minister walked in, he immediately spotted him up in the balcony, and he asked the chairman for permission to hand his document directly to the Prime Minister. And he did. And so the Prime Minister walked down partway, and he walked the other distance, and there was a hand-to-hand handing of this document. And, of course, then he wanted the Prime Minister to respond. Well, the Prime Minister was really on the spot. But he first said, well, I've just now received this. I don't know what's in it. I've had no chance to prepare any kind of an answer to this. He said, obviously, I will give an answer to it. But there was enough pressure that he got on the microphone. And it was really an eloquent, short, but very kind of cogent statement that he made. And he said the Indian, basically, is a Canadian. And he said, we're all Canadians. And he said, we have to do this together. The Indian, the Eskimo, was simply saying, we're a people in a kayak without a paddle. Well, the Prime Minister said, it's good that at least you have a kayak. He said, it will be easier for the two of us to make a proper paddle than it would be to start to make both a kayak and a paddle. And that's the way he started it off. And then he said that we are working on this. He says, one of the problems, he said, that you Indians, you Eskimos, really are not sure what you want. You want to be primitive. You want all of the things that your forefathers have had and those rights and privileges, but you also want to be modern. Now, he said, the problem we have is working out what you really want and what will satisfy the desires of your people. And he said, we're willing to work with you on it, and we want to work with you on it. Well, it was an interesting sidelight in the conference. It was beautiful. Now, there was another confrontation that I should tell you about. And that is in relationship to the Philippines. The Tondo, foreshore area in Manila became a very important kind of thing at the conference. One of the reasons was that the World Council of Churches had taken a position in Manila. And the World Council of Churches, this is the settlement, incidentally, of several thousands of people who are squatters on the waterfront in Manila. And Manila decided that they wanted to clear up this waterfront and build housing for these people that would be something other than the hovels and the shacks that were there. Now, they simply came in. The government came in and bulldozed out the houses that the squatters had built. And in place, they put in more modern kinds of cubicle kinds of structures, you see. And then they charged the people to move into those houses. And the problem was that they could not afford to move back into the houses. And so this had become really a worldwide point that was being watched. And when the wife of the president of the Philippines arrived, The World Council of Churches elected to carry on a demonstration at the conference, at the conference center, the Queen Elizabeth Theater. And so we got placards, and we simply were there in silence, but very much in evidence, and simply saying that the rights of these people should be regarded as something sacred. Furthermore, there was a representation which the World Council had provided money for these people to be present at the Habitat Forum and Conference. And the government had arrested them. And so they were detained. And the day before they were to leave, there were 2,000 people detained and held, religious leaders and the squatters, so that they were not there. Well, our protest was that they were not allowed to have a voice. And so that made headlines in the Vancouver paper. And the publicity, really, I think, was a rather damaging thing for the point of what had been done by the government in the Philippines. So that's just a sidelight again, but it was an important accent point in the conference. Another point that kept coming up and was addressed was the Jonata colony in Bombay. Now, this is a colony of over 32,000 people. And again, it's a squatter's colony. And it's in the undesirable part of the Bombay area, of course, in many ways. But the government, again, elected to move into this area because land is becoming scarce in the downtown areas, you see, in all of these cities. And the government wanted to set up, at that point, a nuclear research study area. And they cleared a part of this area to put in 300 homes, and they displaced these people. They gave them a place where they simply transported them out to the outer edge of the city and put them in homes out there. So they rehoused them. But the problem was that all of these people, whatever earning capacity they had, was downtown. It is in the middle of the city, and they had no real way of transporting themselves from the outer community to the inner city, and they just couldn't make a go of it in this way. So this was another major problem, looking at housing again and human settlement. Another one that came up was in Mexico City, and there were others, you know. In the presentations, just one after one, we heard about the major cities of the world and what the situations were on the peripheries. And in every case, you see, in one case, in Mexico City now, there's something in the order of 700 to 800, almost 750,000 of people that are coming in on the outer fringes of the city annually. And they don't know what in the world to do with them. They can't plan ahead for them. And they, you know, there's no way to really be prepared to take care of this kind of an influx from the urban areas to the cities, because at least they have a better chance of making a living in the city than they have out in the urban areas. And that's where the real problem is. Now, another main thing was land and land use. This became a very important issue all through the conference. And I think that I became impressed as I listened to all of the countries that land, as we think of it, is a commodity. You buy an acre of land. You own an acre, and you think of it as a commodity. Now, worldwide, the point was made repeatedly, land is not an ordinary commodity. When you think of the land of the earth and the people of the earth, what right, you know, do you have to buy and own land privately? And the third world countries were repeatedly making this point. They said, why do you buy it? Why do you hold it? And you hold it, and you hold it without anything on it. You know, why do you do that? You do it for speculative reasons. You do it to make a profit. and you buy up the land around the city that you know is going to expand. You know the land will become more valuable, but you hold the land, you see, without anything on it until you can get your profit. And then you reap the benefits of the community coming in and this kind of thing. So land is not an ordinary commodity. Well, this is one of the most sticky things, you see, to the American and to the United States. To me, I own a property, and you do too, probably. So, you know, it's a question of private ownership, government ownership, or community ownership of land. Now, in the Fiji Islands, the Fijians own the land. And if the government wants any land, they rent it from the Fiji community. And there are other places in the third world where this is a very common pattern, where the community owns the land and decides how the land is to be used. You see, although the Hindi or the Indians have come into the Fiji Islands, they can't get the land. They can do everything, but they can't get that unless the Fijians give it to them. Now, in Sweden, one of the best, it was thought that one of the best ways that there was in handling this problem, where you have really an affluent society and you have both private and public ownership, was that the Swedish government takes care of this situation through legislation. They build in laws and whatever is necessary to control land. They don't always own it, but they control it. And in that way, you can plan ahead, and cities can do things. And if the parliament, you see, declares that a certain area is to be zoned in a certain way, then, in a sense, they do this. And it's the people who have the control through the parliament. Now, the other sense, you see, is in our own country and in most of the Western world, where private ownership really is pretty much the dictating kind of thing. And so then it becomes a question of how you capture the increase from this. And the windfall tax, of course, was one of the things that was very much debated, and that this is a way of controlling it, so that we might do something in that way. But the point is that with the increasing population, land should not be allowed to be vacant. We have too much need for the land for it to be vacant. Government controls of the land, of course, was the main theme that the Third World was bringing on. Now, another important point for the women is that in most of the world, women have no rights to land. And they had some very articulate people who spoke to this at both the forum and also made things very available to the delegates of the conference, that this is something that must be examined and corrected. And in the United States, as you know, somewhere between 2.5 million and 1 million acres, depending on how you count this, we're losing land to the urban spread, the urban sprawl. We're losing good farmland. And the highest figure I've seen, and this was a Sierra Club person who said that 2.4 million acres of good farmland are now going each year to the development of urban areas around the cities and are taken out of agricultural production. So that, I think a figure, I know 1 million acres is a conservative figure, but certainly there is that much. So whether it's 1 million or 2.5 million, you see, it's a very important amount. Well, let me just take a minute to tell you how we'd grappled with this on a day-to-day basis. And I'll just give you that we had a theme a day that we addressed. And so during the 2 weeks' time, this is the way we got through it. All of these problems I've been stating. May 31st, which was the first working day that we had, was man-made and the natural environment. That was the topic for the whole day, both conference and forum. We addressed ourselves to that. The next day was social justice and the question of differing values and cultures. So, social justice, differing values and cultures. Now that's a good day's work, worldwide. Sharing and managing the world's resources. A whole day was devoted to sharing and managing the world's resources. Well, it'd be just fascinating to take a whole period to just talk about what was said in these different sessions. The next day was national resettlement policies. What kind of a policy do we have in the United States for resettlement? This became a very sticky issue politically, see, because of the Israeli-Arab conflict. And so there was real dissent, and it split the conference finally downtown. But the Habitat Forum, you see, really was not that much affected by it. We listened to both sides very impatiently at times, but there wasn't really anything we could do about it. But the downtown conference was split on this. June 4th, people's participation in planning and implementation. This is the right of the people to participate. And this was a very hot issue, obviously. The next day, visions of the future, getting it done, you know. And here, Buckminster Fuller was really the key person in this whole day. And he held forth, he stood out in the sun in an open forum where we couldn't put him in any place because there were too many people to hear him. And there were about 3,500 people, you see, out there, and he talked to them. And he talked for 2 hours, you know, just running a rapid fire, which is fascinating. And then he was present in other groups in smaller sessions, so I heard him, I think, three different times. And it would be just fascinating to tell you what he said. And he had some ideas, you know. He thinks he can figure this all out and get some solutions. Well, Sunday, June the 6th, was Water Day. And they had a water walk from a beach area about a half a mile or a mile and a half away, and you carried a bucket. This is what people have to do. Half of the people in the world are carrying buckets of water in order to have water in their home. So we had a water walk, and we had the whole day devoted to this problem. And incidentally, this will be the subject of the next UN conference. And it's a big hassle is where it's going to be, but it'll be somewhere. And they're going to be working on water. The next day was land use and ownership. And here's where all of the arguments surfaced then for land use and land ownership. And the next day was community action for a better habitat. Community action, I see. And how do you get it done in that way? And on June the 9th, rural development, as opposed to urban development, you see. And how do you get the pressure off of the cities? And the next day was appropriate technology. And believe me, this was a very much debated area. What is appropriate technology? Well, basically, you see, it's technology that is useful and helpful in a local area, not transported in with a culture transported in with it. And anything that you can do to increase the betterment of a community with its own local resources and this kind of thing. And it was really, I think, one of the highlight kinds of things that the conference debated. And certainly a good thing. Wonderful. And then the last day was an evaluation. Well, in the next minute or a few minutes, maybe we can kind of evaluate at least my overall impressions of what was really gained. Now, there are many people that would tell you that the conference was a failure. You know, But I would say in my own mind that the conference and the forum was really a happening, a worldwide happening. That's my feeling about it. And I think the greatest thing about the conference is that it happened. 131 participating nations got together in one place and talked about human problems that relate to their community, their settlement, and everything that was important to the human, including religion, education, housing, energy, the infrastructures, the services, and the existence, you see, of a community. And I think that you can't deny that something good must come out of this kind of a conference. Just because we sat down and talked to one another, we shared technologies, we shared our differences, very vocally, many points. But at least we heard one another, and that's the beginning of some kind of an understanding. It's really the first world conference that really dealt with the quality of human existence. The first one. And I think it's great that we're doing this. Now, that's the Habitat Forum. And that was the part that I was most involved in, really, as a member of the non-government organization. Now the conference itself, that's the political body downtown. Now that was a different story. Now here the whole situation got politicized and they got wound up in politics, they got wound up in all kinds of petty things that really took the substance of the time, and they couldn't agree, and they finally didn't agree on their statement of principles, you know. So you have to say, in many ways, this was a kind of a blot. And the United States and Canada and the other Western countries kind of came out second best because the third world countries got together. And maybe the whole reason they approved getting together was another chance to really do some of the things that they had on their agenda that were really different from the human habitat. You see, Zionism equated with racism. And really, this is the kind of thing that they got tied up in. Now, this was not our major concerns out in the forum. But downtown, the politics, it was all involved. And as a result, we didn't get agreement on things we should have had agreements on. The Jews and the Arabs, you see. And there was even a big hassle out at the Habitat Forum as to how they were going to house them, because they both came with big exhibits. And they finally put them face to face. The Jews were here, the Arabs were here. And there was a corridor where everybody walked between them. And this was against the best judgment of the man who set it up. That is, he really said, well, you got to put them in another building. You know, you put one over here and one over here so we can watch them both. But finally it happened, they put them together. And nothing happened. So, unfortunately. But downtown was a different story. Now, shelter for the poorest, the world's poorest, was a thing that really was not well addressed by the conference itself downtown. And the fourth world, you see, there is a fourth world if you look at it from the point of view of every area has its poorest. In the United States, we have real slum problems. And we have real problems in housing in many areas. So we have a fourth world. You can call it a third world if you wish. But it isn't because we don't have resources and that kind of thing. But we have a fourth world problem. And every country has this. So that was a kind of a common thing that we couldn't get together on, mainly because of the land problems and this sort of thing. And there should have been a better agreement on a database and more research and some money provided for it. This did not come out in the conference. It was agreed that there maybe should be a new organization to handle these kinds of problems in the United Nations. But countries felt that, well, we already have a development kind of committee within the United Nations. Why don't we channel it through that and not build another organization? Well, they didn't provide any structure. They didn't provide any funds. So they kind of deferred it to the next UN meeting to see what they might do with it. Maybe something will come out, but it didn't come out in the conference downtown. Another disappointment was that China was not represented. One-fifth of the people of the world were not there. Except, and I would point out one other thing that was very important, and a new thing that happened at this conference is that they had films. And China was well represented by films. And I saw quite a number of those films. And there was over $3 million expended for films, and they were running constantly, so that if you didn't want to go to hear a speech, you could go see a film. It was produced in the country by their own people and said what they wanted it to say. And now this film library is going to be kept at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. That was a decision that was made. And it's going to be funded, and it's going to be available. So, and I think that really here at Holden, we ought to see some of these films.
They're on a loan basis, but
it'll be. We think so. We think so. Really, the ground rules were not spelled out, but at least that we know of it, we can make inquiry, and I'm sure it'll be available. Well, one of the sad things I thought at the forum was that so much of our time was consumed in the debate about the nuclear moratorium. This became a consuming kind of thing, and we forgot about the human habitat and the human resettlement problem. And it became, again, people who had an agenda, and it was mainly people who were against nuclear power who were there. There was no really good voice for any proponent of nuclear energy. It was just set up against it. And anyone that got up and spoke anything in favor of it were booed. You know, there wasn't even a rational kind of consideration given to the consideration of it. And so it became a blot, really, on the conference. And, you know, even the dignitaries interrupted other, you know, a speaker who would get up to speak his point of view, and even get interrupted during a speech. Well, it was just discourtesy, and it was an emotional kind of thing, not a rational treatment of the problem in any sense. So that was a blot. I think another bad thing was that really the forum was dominated by North America and Europe, because the people could afford to get there. The poor people of the world were not there. There were people who said they were speaking for them, but you had to accept that with tongue in cheek. They were not speaking for themselves. So from point of view of participation, they weren't there. There was a lot of smoke and steam let off on multinational corporations. You know, this was just like nuclear energy. They really took off on it, and a lot of time was consumed against corporations, you see, who are controlling things worldwide, this kind of thing. And the third world was pushing for some kind of an organization of a new economic order. And they felt they didn't get this pushed far enough. But they did push it as far as they could, and that sort of thing. And I think the cost of all of this, well, it was tremendous, $42 million, so was the estimate, you know, of what it cost to put this on. And somebody said, why didn't you save the $42 million and do something, at least in one community? Well, I really think that's a short-sighted way of looking at it. I would say the $42 million is a small pittance to direct to this kind of a worldwide problem. And I would say it was money well spent, and so it's a matter of how you look at it. Canada put out $18 million just to have it there as the host, but The estimate was that, well, maybe 17 million came back through the hotels and the food places and all the others. So there was a lot of money brought in. So they probably were not too far in the red. What's the church's follow-up from this point on? Now, we decided, and we met regularly as a World Council of Church representation. Methodists and others and Lutherans got together on a kind of a regular basis, and we had our own debates about these things and what we can do about it within our own churches. We have elected to meet in San Francisco early in September, and we're going to make a thrust to the Lutheran, to the major boards, to get this into the stream of the program of social concern and social ministry, you see, through each of the major Lutheran bodies. And so I feel that here at Holden, you know, I can kind of talk to all three in this sense, and I hope that each of you in your respective synod will kind of give this a boost, because I think that it should become an important part of our world concern. Not only food, but shelter, habitation, community, and all of the services that go with this. We should be raising the consciousness level of our people in our own congregation, because we sit at the top of the pinnacle, you see, in this kind of a problem. And the third world countries, it's a question of how we're going to accomplish something to help them help themselves and to be helpful to them. And that, I think, is the important thing. Now, I think we need to develop this kind of a thing at the congregational level, all the way through our country. And I would urge that we do this. And I think with that, I expect our time is up. Is that right? And so I think I'll just close at this point. And let me tell you that I have here the official handbook and all of the literature that's available at the present time. This is a $15 volume. And I'll just put it in the library here on the desk, and you can browse through it. And if you're really interested in really following this to find out what really went on, you know, we had a newspaper that came out every morning with the activities and the program for the day. And here you can see the headlines. Is that all you need is love. That's Trudeau. See, this is the speech that I was telling you about.
How many children does he have now?
I don't know.
Somewhere around four.
I think so.
I don't know.
They're going to know. It's maybe five.
And here's the nuclear headline. So you see, you just kind of look at the headlines here. And here's the freeze out. By the third or fourth day, everybody was chilled to the bones. And that's what that was. And that's when they really dug out the Royal Canadian Air Force blankets. We had a few before, but after that, everybody had a blanket. Justice for the poor. You know, and you can just, and really, these are superb digests of what went on, you know, day after day. And so.
Good editors, in other words.
Yeah, it was well covered by the media, you see, and we had a good, and here the group of 77, which is really the third world countries, you know, they weighed in, and they really made their presence felt, and the developed countries really came off second best in many of the things because they simply ganged up. Maybe rightly so.
Was Taiwan represented?
Yes, I think so. I have the list. It's in here. We can look it up. I just don't recall all of them.
Did they say why China wasn't there? Was it because
China? No. Just disappointment was expressed, but no reason. But they are not a single representative.
But China sent the films, though. That
China had the films from China. And the point is, they're really doing the best job in this whole field, probably. Doing more to really take care of the poorest of the poor. If you start at the bottom, I think you have to admit that they are really doing really quite a superb job. Now, you can say a lot of things about a lot of other things. Maybe they aren't doing right. But at least in this area, they probably had a lot to give had they come. You know, we would have listened. But at least I took the advantage of seeing the films because I really felt that that voice should be heard. And I was really very much impressed. And we had several programs on China by people who had spent considerable time in China. Exchange was that, well, they seem to be doing, you know, a good job of taking care of the community in the rural area and getting communities going and getting a labor-intensive economy, really. And they have completely wiped out the profit motive, almost essentially, across the board. And the doctors, I saw a film, one of the most impressive was The Barefoot Doctor. Yeah, it was a good film of that, and really, you know, it's the taking off the cloak of professionalism, and everybody works, from the top person in the government through all of the professions. Everybody does a certain amount of work, and the work is right back to the land, right back to the land. And the premier gets out and plants his rice with everybody else. And there is a sense of community, you see, in doing this together. They simply say, well, we don't have the money to afford the kind of energy that the Western world affords. So we don't do that. We pick up each of us a stone and carry it. Now, and everybody gets his food at the end of the day.
What's your guess on the amount of water? So that most people go for water outside. One except in China is water in the house. Now, they, a lot of in the city, they don't have hot water, but they have water in.
They have water
it's
in.
It's very Spartan existence, but they certainly moved in that direction.
Yeah, that's one of the first things they did, was to provide clean water in their communities. And they provided medical services. For 60 cents a year, the equivalent of 60 cents a year, you buy into the medical plan. That's for a year. And you have all medical services then for 60 cents, equivalent of that. Well, they don't earn much, but at least that's, most of them can afford that, you know. And if they can't, I had the impression that they took care of them some way. But they're very short of doctors, they're very short of help, but they have all kinds of paramedical, you know, and things of this kind. Well, I have a mind hack.
Thanks very much.